This Intelligent Medicine podcast is brought to you by Cedarside.com, your all-natural, organic solution to pest control problems, protecting people, pets, and premises. Cedarside.com. Welcome to the Intelligent Medicine Podcast. I'm your host, Dr. Ronald Hoffman, and from time to time, usually on a weekly basis, if I can get around to it, we do a clinical-focused podcast that specifically tackles one or another disease or theme in the world of medicine or nutrition. And today we're going to tackle multiple sclerosis, which is a very common problem. It's the most common neurological disease that affects younger people, especially women. I believe the ratio is somewhere like 4 to 1, where women are more affected than men with this medical condition that can cause numbness, weakness, that is sometimes relapsing and remitting and sometimes progressive. These are some subclassifications of multiple sclerosis. Typically, on an MRI, white spots appear in the brain and signify damage to the myelin, which is a sheathing or coat around the neurons or the nerves. And thus, patients experience decreased sensory and also decreased motor neurological symptoms. And it is a condition which affects an estimated 1 in 1,000 individuals in the United States and North America. One clue, and we'll investigate in part one, some of the theories and risk factors for multiple sclerosis, theories as to its causation. And in part two, we'll talk about some of the proposed treatments and treatments that are used in complementary and alternative medicine. The condition is something which occurs predominantly in civilized or advanced countries, and it occurs in the northern hemisphere and in the southern latitudes far from the equator. And so these factors may give us some clues as to causation with opportunities for intervention that may help to turn this condition around. In terms of current treatments, conventional treatments involve the use of beta interferon, which is an injectable medication that is sometimes effective at slowing the progression of the disease, but often it wears out because the body develops antibodies to the drug. And also, it causes unpleasant side effects. Many patients who get these injections report flu-like symptoms, malaise, hair loss, other autoimmune problems like thyroid conditions and vitiligo are sometimes associated with the use of these medications. And there's another medication called Copaxone, which is an Israeli medication that works okay. It's not that toxic. It's a 4-amino acid that stimulates protective T cells, kind of an ingenious medication. But these medications only somewhat reduce relapse rate, and they don't cure the disease. And then there's a new powerful medication that's part of the arsenal of monoclonal antibody drugs that we now use for conditions like psoriasis and ulcerative colitis and rheumatoid arthritis. The drug is called Tysabri. And it is a powerful drug that really shuts down the immune system. The thought is that autoimmunity is the cause of multiple sclerosis. And by suppressing the immune system, we can get the body to relent in its attack upon the nerves. But Tysabri, while sometimes effective, should be used with great caution because it has a terrible potential side effect, which is that it causes a condition called PML, progressive multi centric leukoencephalopathy. It's actually a hard word to pronounce. It's an unusual brain disease in which the brain literally liquefies. And this is a progressive, disastrous, fatal condition. Tysabri is something that we want to only use as a very last resort. Because of the lack of a magic bullet that's uniformly effective in the treatment of multiple sclerosis, it's a ripe field for natural intervention. And so let's look at some of the issues that suggest a direction in which we can take natural therapy. One is the observation that this occurs often in modern, industrialized, advanced cultures. And then there, due to this, we can invoke what is termed the hygiene hypothesis, which is the notion that early in life, people in primitive or third world societies get exposed to a lot of germs. And in fact, many people are infested with intestinal parasites. And in the West, we use antibiotics frequently, and we have sanitary conditions, and we vaccinate our kids, and we prevent them from getting infections. And the result is that we have a good thing, which is less infant mortality and less of a toll from infectious diseases. But the trade-off is that we have more allergies and more autoimmune diseases. And this has something to do with what the immunologists call TH1, TH2 imbalance. It's a sort of a seesaw balance between robust immunity to bacteria versus autoimmunity and allergy. And in the West, because of hygiene, we tend to get more autoimmune diseases, including MS. And the proof of the pudding is that there's actually now investigation of the possibility of using pig whipworm therapy. We actually introduce what is considered a harmless parasite into the gastrointestinal tract of individuals with autoimmune diseases like ulcerative colitis and multiple sclerosis. And we can demonstrate a reduction in symptoms and a slowing in the progression of the disease. There's ongoing research on that. It's not clear if this is going to be a practical avenue towards the treatment, but it suggests that our Western habits of hygiene and over-reliance on vaccination and antibiotics may have something to do with the high rate of multiple sclerosis. The fact that multiple sclerosis occurs at extremes of latitude, in relatively more common in the far north and the far south, in southern parts of Australia and New Zealand, in the southern hemisphere, in northern Europe, United States, and Canada, and northern parts of Asia, suggests it may have something to do with vitamin D. And indeed, there's a vitamin D connection that we're going to explore in part two. It's quite fascinating, quite promising. Vitamin D may protect against autoimmunity. We know that it protects against autoimmunity in conditions like rheumatoid arthritis, and hence it may have applicability in multiple sclerosis. We also know that the Western diet has changed, that it is refined, bereft of nutrients, and high in chemical ingredients. Things like hydrogenated fat may gum up the works in cells and create problems. And also there's the issue of lack of essential fatty acids. And this is something that has been explored. There are some diet studies that have been undertaken with multiple sclerosis. Actually, the longest continuous diet study in relationship to a disease was undertaken by Dr. Roy Swank, starting in 1949, wherein he began to apply what is now termed the Swank diet to patients with MS. And he documents the progression or lack thereof in patients who followed his dietary advice over several decades, lasting into, I believe it was the 1970s or even the 1980s. And I've heard him speak. It was, I think, in the 1990s that I heard him speak. He's quite elderly. I'm not even sure if he's still alive, but it is quite a monumental work. And his dietary protocol was to eliminate as much as possible saturated fat. He suggested no red meat consumption, and then only occasional red meat after the first year. The diet relied on white meat, poultry, fish, and shellfish, and eliminated dairy products containing a high saturated fat content. And in addition, it was recommended that patients take cod liver oil, which is interesting because cod liver oil has three things in it. It has vitamin A, and it has a lot of vitamin D in it, and it also has a lot of omega-3 fatty acids, EPA and DHA. And so it's not really clear to me whether the Swank diet, which is low in saturated fat, is really doing the trick in multiple sclerosis, because kind of going against that is a recent large study using data from the Nurses' Health Study, which involves literally tens of thousands of nurses. And it found no evidence linking the risk of MS with the intake of saturated fats. The authors did, however, note that intake of linolenic acid, which is present in flax oil, it's an omega-3 oil from plants, but not fish oils or DHA, was associated with a trend towards a lower risk for MS. Other studies have shown a favorable effect of omega-3 supplementation, but these studies are a little bit weak and not that rigorous. So when it comes to diet, a popular diet that is now advocated for MS is the paleo diet, most recently embraced by Dr. Terry Walls. Dr. Walls is a physician who herself was stricken with MS, and it was rapidly progressing, and she was practically confined to a wheelchair with very, very dim prospects for continuing as a medical professional because of her disability. And she began doing research on dietary and natural approaches to MS. She now has a very active campaign to get the word out to MS patients about the Walls Protocol, and has written a book entitled The Walls Protocol, which embraces the paleo diet. It's a cereal-free diet. It's, of course, gluten-free, and it's dairy-free. And it's also a variant of the paleo diet that is high in organ meat and very, very high in healthy vegetables and fruits, which are thought to provide nutrients that help to quench inflammation. Inflammation is a key factor in MS because inflammation seems to be implicated in the destruction of the myelin in the brain. And so taking lots of anti-inflammatory nutrients could be a key to slowing the progression of the disease. Some studies suggest that viruses may play a role in the causation of MS. It's actually thought that exposure to the Epstein-Barr virus can disrupt the immune system response. It sort of has an excitatory effect on the immune system, and the immune system, in an over-exuberant attempt to quench the Epstein-Barr virus in mononucleosis or chronic Epstein-Barr virus, that this over-exuberant immune response may go awry and the immune system may attack the nervous system. I've actually seen some patients progress from what seemed like chronic fatigue syndrome or chronic viral syndrome, a mono-like prolonged situation, to MS. And so that may be part of what causes the immune system disruption. There's also been concern raised over the potential for environmental toxins to disrupt the immune system. There's so many chemicals in the environment that we can't keep track of them. In addition, mercury is thought to be very toxic to the nerve cells, and mercury can accumulate in the brain. And we often check for mercury levels and try to detoxify patients both by restricting sources of mercury like tuna, sushi, and certain fish. Sometimes if dental fillings are a problem, we address that. But we also may undertake chelation of mercury to get it out of the system. and thus create less of a toxic burden on the nervous system. Is stress a potential factor in MS? Well, clearly having MS is stressful. It's a devastating condition for some people, so that's kind of goes with the territory of having MS. But could stress be something that could accelerate the cascade of autoimmunity? And the answer is that high levels of cortisol sometimes cause breaches in the blood-brain barrier. The blood-brain barrier normally keeps bad substances away from the brain, therefore there may be a more easy transport of harmful or toxic substances into the brain due to the effects of stress. Stress also alters the gastrointestinal tract. It may promote leaky gut syndrome. There's often a consideration in autoimmune disease of, you know, what's happening in the intestinal tract. Has a patient taken lots of antibiotics? Have they disturbed their natural intestinal flora? Could gut toxicity play a role? Could altered intestinal permeability or leaky gut allow the intestinal toxic elements or food allergens to traverse the intestinal wall, get into the blood circulation, ultimately cross the blood barrier and attack the brain? That is at least theoretically a consideration when we try to clean up the GI tracts of patients who suffer from MS. Is there a relationship to food intolerance? Well, there's actually pretty strong evidence that patients who have celiac disease have a higher incidence of autoimmunity and brain disorders. That's actually the basis of the book Grain Brain by complementary neurologist Dr. David Perlmutter, who's a frequent guest here on Intelligent Medicine. You may have read his book or followed his Facebook or Twitter account. And he's a big proponent of the notion that sometimes mysterious neurological conditions, Alzheimer's, dementia, Parkinson's disease, Lou Gehrig's disease, and MS could at least in part be triggered by the autoimmunity that is exaggerated by the body's response to gluten. When you have celiac disease, it sort of sets your whole immune system on fire. And many patients don't just have gastrointestinal symptoms. They often have body-wide symptoms. When speaking to Dr. Alexio Fasano, who was an expert on celiac disease, he coined a phrase in his book about celiac disease: what happens in the gut doesn't stay in the gut. So sometimes gastrointestinal problems that may be triggered by gluten or other food allergens can traverse the gut wall, get into the bloodstream, and attack distant organs. We know that, for example, one manifestation of celiac disease is cerebellar ataxia, which is a balance problem. It's not MS, but it's a problem that is akin to MS. MS patients often have balance problems. And that's, though it's a different part of the brain that's specifically attacked there, at least that's a model for how celiac disease or gluten intolerance may make things worse for patients suffering from MS. And, you know, clearly there's a role for genetics here, that some people may be genetically predisposed. We haven't specifically nailed down the MS gene or gene complex, but some people clearly, when faced with various types of stressors and environmental challenges and toxicities and food allergies, these individuals may be more likely to flip the switch towards autoimmunity, where their nerve cells and myelin gets targeted and destroyed. Clearly, there's a role for certain types of nutritional deficiency. We know that the body uses antioxidants to combat free radicals. Whenever there's an inflammatory process in the body requires more antioxidants, and a poor diet that is bereft of nutrients leaves the body more vulnerable to free radical attack. That's part of the mechanism by which MS destroys neurons and damages myelin. So this suggests that patients could utilize a diet rich in plant antioxidants, as well as nutraceuticals and our traditional family of antioxidants, which we'll talk about in part two. A very important antioxidant is glutathione. It's actually one of the most important antioxidants in the body as a whole, but specifically in the brain. And so the constituents of glutathione are selenium, cysteine, which can be administered as N-acetylcysteine, glutamine. These are precursors for glutathione, or glutathione can be administered intravenously, or some people take oral forms of glutathione that are bioavailable, or use transdermal forms to get glutathione into the system and raise levels of that. Another factor, and you know, I think we just have to generally enter this in, is that one of the ways that the brain functions is via its fuel source. And if your fuel source is glucose, it's an unreliable fuel source, because blood sugar levels fluctuate dramatically in many individuals, and particularly if you have a brain problem. I'm not saying that blood sugar problems cause MS, but if you've got hypoglycemia and you have a normal brain, you're going to have a bad day. If you have hypoglycemia when you have MS, you may have a major exacerbation of your symptoms. So this is a factor, and when we switch to a fat-based fuel of the brain, when we put patients on a higher fat diet, particularly beneficial fats, and reduce their carbohydrates, this is the recipe that's in the book Grain Brain for Brain Disorders, then the brain starts to operate off of what are called ketones. Ketones can reliably fuel the brain, and there's no fluctuations usually in their levels, and this actually may promote better brain function, particularly when the brain is sort of limping along at maybe, you know, 20 or 30% deficiency. It's not like parts of the brain totally die in MS. It's almost like parts of the brain are browned out and are operating at less than peak efficiency. So another consideration there, you know, we talk about if you've got parts of the brain that are injured or operating suboptimally, we have to talk about mitochondrial support. The mitochondria are areas of the brain that may require higher levels of things like coenzyme Q10 or carnitine, or specific nutrients that rev their function. Ubiquinol is a new player. Ribose is sometimes used to promote mitochondrial metabolism, and magnesium and B vitamins play a role in that process. So the notion of enhancing mitochondrial function may be of crucial importance in MS. Another problem that MS patients have is because they have poor nerve function going down to the bladder, is they may have poor emptying of the bladder and frequent urinary tract infections. We sometimes address that by giving patients a product called D-mannose. D-mannose is a type of sugar that may coat the lining of the bladder and prevent the adhesion of bacteria to the bladder, in particular E. coli, which is responsible for a high percentage of bladder infections. And as a result, I have MS patients who had frequent infections before seeing me, and when they routinely dose with D-mannose, they have less frequent infections. So this is about as far as I want to go in part one, is we're sort of outlining themes and causes and potential entry points for intervention with MS. In part two, we're going to focus on specific strategies and potential treatments that I've actually used to help MS patients. I have to say that I'm very excited about the prospect of intervening with MS patients. I've treated quite a few in my career, and the vast majority are doing quite well. Many of them able to stop using conventional medications, and many of them remaining in remission for long periods of time, or at the very least slowing the progression of the disease considerably.